tonight on Arena. In film reviews, Jurassic World Rebirth, Hot Milk, The Shrouds and Beat the Lotto. And Amy Bloom on her latest novel, I'll Be Right Here. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. And on our film reviews tonight, Mutant Dinosaurs, Codependent Mothers and Daughters, A Widower with a Morbid Obsession, and How to Beat the Lotto. I'm really interested in that one. Hot Milk, Fiona Shaw brings us the ultimate nightmare Irish mammy whose codependent daughter, played by Emma Mackey, is at the end of her tether. Beat the Lotto is Ross Whittaker's new feature documentary about the attempt made by a confident maths boffin to win big, leaving nothing to chance. In The Shrouds, Canadian auteur David Cronenberg reflects on bereavement with a unique take on staying connected to the dead. Donald Clark and Serena Bellissimo have been watching or been to the cinema. They're both with me in studio this evening, and we'll start with Jurassic World Rebirth. Stars Scarlett Johansson and Bridgerton's own Jonathan Bailey in an adventure revolving around being trapped on an island with land, air and seaborne megafauna, which is my new word for big creatures.
Megafauna.
Megafauna.
Yeah.
You can also use it to speak through.
Anyway, megafauna. Ganzafauna.
Ganzafauna, exactly. Donald, we are returning, I suppose, well, Jurassic Park, obviously a classic movie. We are returning to, I think, kind of... We're making dinosaurs great again, aren't we? In this,
I think we kind of are. Well, that's pretty overstating the case, but I mean, it's a funny. I mean, so many of these franchises are just inviting us to value hope over experience. So many of them, you know, people approach this and say, "I hope this is one of the good ones," without thinking, "Well, there've been only been two good ones, and kind of, you know, 15 terrible ones." I mean, Ridley Scott recently basically more or less owned up that there are only really two good Alien films. Jurassic Park.
And did he make both of them?
No, he didn't, be fair. He was, yeah, okay. He's allowing James Cameron as director of the other one,
Right.
But in this case, I mean, yeah, the first one was great. I mean, it wasn't not one of my favourite films, but it functioned brilliantly, yeah. And it was obviously groundbreaking in its way. Second one was terrible. Third one was fine. Third one is the underrated one, I think. And the last three were appalling. But nonetheless, made a vast amount of money. I like this one. This, for me, is... It was too reductive to say it's going back to basics.
Yeah.
But the last three were incredibly complicated and flew through a thousand genres at the wall to see which stuck. And I'd also had Chris Pratt in the middle, which I can do without. This is kind of basically a mission film. That you have a chap from Big Pharma played by Rupert Friend. Okay. Will the chap from Big Pharma turn out to be less trustworthy than he seems? I'll let you guess.
And I wonder, is he going to be the villain? I wonder.
I know, you can never guess these things. Anyway, he's got a scheme which he requires a party of individuals to go to one of the islands where the dinosaurs still are, extract some organic matter, and crucially, only when they're alive. And you get a whole kind of battle exposition thing explaining why they have to be alive. Well, they have to be alive because it's no fun otherwise. Okay? If you shoot them and extract it, we get no adventure. Anyway, so they get a party together. The party is Scarlett Johansson as a special ops person, Mahershala Ali as the guy who captains the boat, and you've also got Jonathan Bailey as the anthropologist along for the ride. And it's very straightforward.
And Scarlett Johansson, she working alongside Bailey's character? Are they?
Yes, they're together.
She's leading the mission.
She seems to be in charge, yes, from what I can gather. It's very straightforward. They're propelled onto it. There's also a family as well who also end up on the same island, making their way in a kind of like in mission mode to get off the island and along the way accomplish this task that Rupert Friend has set for them. And the action set pieces are very efficient. They work well. Okay. There's also, I think, crucially, Gareth Edwards, who directed this, is a very smart director. He directed Rogue One, I think the best of the most recent string of Star Wars films. And he has a thing going back to his first film, Monsters, for a kind of a sense of wonder about these things, which actually is very Spielbergian.
Yeah, and you get the original Jurassic Park.
And you get one sequence here where you go back to that sense of wonder, and I was grateful for that, and I was enough to say, okay, that will do me. This is officially one of the good ones.
That Will Do Me is not going to be on the poster, I don't think. Scarlett Johansson's Zora and Jonathan Bailey as Henry are in this clip that we're about to hear, and they're getting the lowdown on this island from Rupert Friend as the farmer guy. Can we trust him? Let's find out.
Mr. Work here didn't tell us everything that we need to know.
Look, this island was a laboratory of sorts. They conducted experimental work here.
What kind of experiments?
Crossbreeding of species, engineered entertainments, they call them.
Genetically altered freaks?
Any that were malformed or just too damn hard for anybody to look at, they left them here.
Well, that's inhuman. Why not just euthanize them?
The average cost of a created species is $72 million. What would you do? Kill it and have to tell your bank, or just carry it forward under R&D?
What would I do with mutant dinosaurs from an accounting perspective? Is that really the question?
Oh, the pharma guy is all interested in money and accountancy. That's
surprise,
a surprise. However, I think, Serena, you were particularly taken by both Scarlett Johansson and Jonathan Bailey. Is there a chemistry between them? Is there something more than just colleagues going on here?
No, it's a lovely friendship chemistry between the two of them, which they've played up, not played up, which they've continued to do on the red carpet. What I realised watching this is that I will watch Jonathan Bailey do anything, and I love that Jonathan Bailey has not been typecast. We originally saw him in Bridgerton, we saw him be fantastic in Wicked, and now we've seen him as this anthropologist, paleontologist. I think he's great. There's also Mahershala Ali, who I haven't seen in a while. I loved him in this. I loved Rupert Friend. He's a great baddie.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, I don't understand. This goes for 2 hours and 14 minutes, okay? There's no need for this to go for
film to be longer than 90 minutes.
Right. Also, as they managed to hone it down somewhat, I mean, hone it down some more and make it a palatable length.
Do you know how they could have honed it down some more? Nothing against the family. They did not need to be there. It was like this added storyline.
Yeah, that almost
storyline.
Felt like they feel that one of the parts of the formula is children, going back to the first one.
Get rid of them.
I don't care about that.
There was actually no need for them in this. It was about the dinosaurs. If you're going to see this, I think this is just for the fans. Or if you have never, ever seen Jurassic Park and know nothing about it, you're going to walk in.
Would we get a few jump scares, though, like we did in the original?
Yeah, I think young kids and kids who are quite scared may be a bit. I wouldn't take them
See this. The kids are pretty awful.
Yeah, yeah. I think that might be a bit frightening for them. Having said that, go and see that. If you are going to see this, go see it on the biggest screen possible because it is beautiful. And I love, here's a little fun fact for you. I love that Jonathan Bailey, not only does he act in this, but he also joined in the recording of the score. Yeah. So he went down to Abbey Road, to watch them because he was really into it, and he was watching it, and then Alexander Desplat, who was organising the score, and he was like, "Do you want to sit in?" And they're like, "Oh, okay," because he plays the clarinet, and then he said, "Do you want to play a solo?" And the first time he said no, and then the second time he went, "I better say yes." So not only is he acting in this, he's playing a solo.
He's playing the clarinet.
Yes.
Too talented by far.
We
can't give stars for the clarinet playing. But
I'll give him a 5 for that.
5 for the clarinet playing. Did you know? Recognize the solo when he came up?
Of course I did.
Overall for the film, what are you saying, Serena?
For the film as a standalone, I'll probably give it a 4. But I'm really tired of seeing the same old, I'll give it a 3. But if you're a fan, I think you're going to love it because it's what Donald said. It is just getting back to basics.
Okay. And you, Donald?
A 3.5. I mean, it's probably the third best film in the 7 films, but that's not saying an awful lot because the last 3 were terrible.
Yes.
And can we end it now? Like, can we have no more?
No, you can't because it's one of the few films this summer that's made a fitful of money.
Yeah.
It's opening weekend.
Okay, well, I suppose that has to happen too.
Yeah. We need that for cinema to continue.
All right. So 3.5 and 4, kind of.
Let's say 3.5 as well.
Two, 3.5. Yeah. All right. Which is a little bit better than average, you'd have to say. That is for Jurassic World Rebirth, featuring the megafauna, my new word. next to Hot Milk, Rebecca Lenkovich, is an adaptation of Deborah Levy's novel. This, very complicated mother and daughter relationship here. In, I spoke to Fiona Shaw and Rebecca Lenkovich was the other night.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How were they?
First thing was Fiona Shaw once said, geez, some bit of work was kind of my opening gambit. And Fiona Shaw was straight out of the trap saying, no, why do people say that about her? she says what she thinks was kind of her take on it. The nature of this relationship, though, is it's very difficult to say the very least.
You don't know who's dependent on who, but there's also a lot of manipulation going on in this. And you don't realise that at the beginning, when it starts off, it's just like, oh, poor woman. She's sick woman. Yeah. And how lovely that the daughter is helping her out. And then you go, okay, well, it's sort of been this relationship for a very long time. How sick is she really? Who's depending on, who's mothering who? Is the mother mothering the daughter or is the daughter mothering the mother? Then there's also I have to say straight off, I absolutely love this. Like I went on about, you know, I could watch Jonathan Bailey do anything. I think Fiona Shaw and Emma Mackey are two of the most underrated actresses out there. They are phenomenal and I will watch them doing anything. And I thought it was because of them that this film worked.
All right. I don't know how underrated. I think a lot of people would certainly agree with you that they are very, very watchable, both of them. Let's have a listen to a clip which is quite near to the beginning of the film, and this is the mother and daughter, Fiona Shaw and Emma Mackey, sitting watching this couple having a bit of a row down the beach. Mammy does a lot of speaking here and daughter has to do a lot of watching while Mammy speaks.
Isn't she lovely? Do you think you'll ever marry Fia? There is a reason why the man is called the groom. It's an ominous title.
Siempre con la misma puta historia.
Is that yours? Yes, you. Does that handbag belong to you?
Rose.
He is unbearable even at a distance.
Yeah, Emma Mackey gets one word in the midst of that clip, just Rose. And Fiona Shaw with the lion's share, obviously, well, she's doing the observing and the talking about what she's looking at on the beach. But it is part of this film's, in some ways, part of the difficulty for me was that Fiona Shaw has by far the best lines, like the little jibe there, do you think you'll ever get married, Fia? you know, not an innocent question. And later on she's saying, do you ever think you'll stop studying? Are you going to finish your studies anytime soon? With just that little edge of barb, and Emma Mackey has to kind of absorb all of this and watch everything that's happening, and just with very little to say.
Well, there is around that. When you were talking about the character earlier on and referencing your interview with Fiona Shaw, the phrase "doesn't suffer fools gladly" came into my head, which is one of those euphemisms for bloody rude.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Oh God, I had a paradoxical feeling coming out of this film. I knew it was a novel going in, but my first thought or last thought was, how can that be a novel? I mean, there's almost no plot. What plot there is revolves around the characters eventually sitting down and making exactly the kind of terrible revelation that you expected they were going to make. Mm. By which I mean terrible things would happen to a person, but exactly the kind of things that happen in novels or happen in films, and people at the end have to tell you the terrible thing that explains how they evolved into the character
into the
that
they are.
Now,
yeah.
On reflection then, I thought, well, it could only be a novel because, I mean, I'm glad you enjoyed it more than I did, but I mean, perhaps for me, I can't see any way you would sit down and write a film like this and trust in the dialogue to explain the motion of the characters through the plot. It could only work through internal monologue that you get in a novel.
Yeah.
For me, they just sat there and in uninteresting fashion, doing nothing and saying nothing of any great interest for an hour and a half until eventually the revelations come. And that was not enough for me to justify what had gone before. Having said that, I mean, I do think that you have three very good actors here. Vicky Creeps, which you mentioned as well,
who comes into a kind of a relationship with the Emma Mackey character.
Yeah, but I don't think any of them are really given fleshed out characters that are sufficiently kind of weighty to carry a film for 90 minutes. I mean, it is only 90 minutes. For me, it felt like another hour.
It did feel longer than
slogging my way through.
It felt
this.
Longer than an hour and a half to me too. But what did strike me was, and I don't know the novel very well, so I'm speaking from reading about the novel rather than reading the novel itself. But the character, the daughter character, the Emma Mackey character, is the narrator of the novel, which might explain an awful lot more about what is going on in her life to us than I felt I got in the film. I wanted to know more about her.
Really? I felt like I got enough. I felt like I was just watching life unfold. Mm. And sometimes that's enough. Mother-daughter relationships are quite tricky sometimes. Mm. And I felt that we weren't... Yes, they probably could have gone into depth a little bit more, but I don't feel like this needed it. I honestly just felt like we were at a moment in time in their relationship and we were just watching life unfold.
Yeah. But I felt no form of momentum in it.
That was on purpose.
Yeah. I mean, I felt there were all kind of nudges to me, which I wasn't understood in which direction I was being nudged. I mean, at the beginning, for example, you have this section where they're discussing The Mill and the Floss, one of my favourite novels. And I was thinking, it's obviously has some significance. Obviously the story of Maggie Tulliver has some significance to this plot, but I couldn't make out why.
Yeah, they mentioned it a couple of times.
It just seemed to be like a way of demonstrating or arguing that this is a literally inclined piece.
At the end of my interview with both Fiona Shaw and Rebecca Lenkovich, Rebecca Lenkovich spoke something, and I think Fiona Shaw agreed with her in this, about shame, that ultimately this is a story about shame and female shame in particular. And I thought, I wonder if I watched the film with that a little bit more to the front of my mind, would I see it differently?
I think you possibly, because I feel like I was watching a completely different film to what you guys were watching. I don't know, I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. But I have to admit,
We can't say what the ending is.
I'm
but
just
going to
say
now,
that ending was just like, whoa. And then
good way?
Yes, because then it made everything make sense. And I know we had to wait to the end, but sometimes that's a good film. A good film is when it leads up to this point and then you're thinking about it after the fact.
I certainly did think about the film more after the event, and I'm still thinking about it, but I'm trying to work things out. I wasn't quite in the same place. I was saying wow at the ending, but maybe not in the same way as Serena was.
I felt the revelations were the kind of things that happen in films. terrible for a human being, but you know, unsurprising in a film like this.
Did the performances save it enough for you, Donald?
I'm perfectly happy to watch those three actors in action. I mean, that they're all three are always make something of even the thinnest material. But I did think this was the thinnest material.
Stars on that score then?
Two.
You're in a different place for sure than Donald on this one, Serena.
I'm going to give it a 3.5.
3.5. So it was a much more... I don't know if enjoyable experience was the right way of putting it.
Do you know what? I'm enjoying people taking risks.
3.5.
But I'm giving it a 3.5, and I think the performances. Yeah. And Emma Mackey is going to be the actress of her generation, I think.
Yeah, well, certainly she is very watchable. There is no question about that. All right, let us move on then to Beat the Lotto. Make lotteries great again. Make documentaries great again. Not that they ever have kind of fallen out of being great. This is Ross Whittaker's documentary, Beat the Lotto, a throwback to the early days of the National Lottery in Ireland in the 1980s. Arrives off the back of a win of Best Documentary at the Dublin International Film Festival from the Dublin's Film Critics Circle.
From us, yes.
Yeah, and in which you are involved, obviously. And that might explain why you're both on board with this one. This is like a heist movie, but it is a documentary. It's not a fiction.
But it's so well done. You're watching it. Because honestly, when I was like, we're going to watch a movie, a documentary about something that happened in the 80s related to the lotto, how interesting could this be? I was so wrong. And I love the way Whittaker actually combined archival footage, reenactments, And then interviews, even. I thought it was brilliantly done.
I loved it. I mean, it's in a school of documentary, which I love, which is the tale of something, this wouldn't be the case with you so much, but that you vaguely remember, but never got a complete handle on. So then, oh yeah, it was that thing.
So do you remember this happening?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm sure Sean would as well, but but I mean...
I have a vague memory of it, exactly. But I don't remember the details of it.
I think it wasn't covered in depth, so you had some notion there was this idea, these guys are going to buy all the numbers. I mean, it's the idea is... very simple, is that, and the supposed protection against it is very simple, which is that if it gets to a certain stage where you have a rollover on the weekend, if you can buy all the numbers, then unless, this is the big if, unless there are an unprecedented number of winners, then you're guaranteed a significant profit. Now, I mean, I talked to Stefan about this, Stefan Klinkovich, who was the organiser of it, and I was saying to him, like, the point, I guess, is the protection was that the lottery felt is such a logistic nightmare to fill out all these cards and get all these cards back to the machines that there's a protection against someone doing this. And he said, oh, it wasn't really that hard. It wasn't really that complicated. clearly it was. When you watch the film, it was an enormous operation.
Not that complicated if you've got a magnificent mathematical brain.
That's right. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, I talking to Ross about this as well, that for me, and I get the sense this around this table you felt the same, is that you're entirely behind the syndicate in this case.
Because they're not doing anything illegal.
It's interesting.
I don't know. Sorry to cut in. But I thought, watching this, I was like, I never quite knew who was the hero and who was the villain, because it kept swapping. Because
it cuts back to when they're in the television studio.
Yeah.
And you get a real sense of the audience thinking, well, hang on a second, this is our lottery.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this is the one, the thing. And in a very, very economically straitened time for this country, gives an ordinary guy a chance of becoming
king. It was £1. What do they call it? The £1 dream?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. And also, there was also the sense that the money going back into good projects, into local groups and into football pitches and all kinds of things. But I think now to remove, I think we realize, well, look, let's not be naive. This is a gambling game, and if there is a flaw in the gambling game, then gamblers are free to exploit it.
Yeah, and Ross Whittaker's style of presentation here, it is. I think you both feel it goes back to a kind of an old style of documentary.
He's very cleverly done that.
How does he do that, Serena?
Oh, it's so good. Well, it's the whole, it is a documentary you're watching, but sometimes you forget and you feel like you're watching a film because the reenactments aren't tacky.
There's a few reenactments there too.
But then there's the old footage. It's just, and I think it comes in like 81 minutes or something. It's so succinct. So it's so interesting. I didn't expect to be as captivated by this as I was.
And I think this as well, to go in not knowing what happened at the end, which actually was the case for me. I couldn't quite remember what happened.
No, so we don't need to tell people.
We certainly won't tell you what happened, no.
Stars.
I'm giving it 5. I just thought it was a really, really entertaining film that I can't say a bad word against.
And what do you...
I'm going to give it a 4.
You're giving it a 4. Aye, well, that sounds like it's a bit of fun for sure. Beat the lotto. And finally, on to David Cronenberg. You've seen this one. Sinead Egan, in fact, spoke with David Cronenberg during the week about this one, and very much it's classic Cronenberg area. He doesn't like the term body horror. He made that clear, but we are in a very peculiar place, and his own wife had died, I think, which
it's
was part of
really
part of
interesting
how, what
film
he was,
this
what
I,
he was
I saw
with
this
here.
At Cannes in 2024.
It's taken
14 months to get here, but trouble with distribution. And you kind of see why. It's interesting that it came 2 years after Crimes of the Future, his previous film, which is a much more traditionally Cronenbergian film.
Yeah.
It did have body horror in it, as you suggest. There's not really anything you call body horror in this film, I would argue. Whereas this
the basic premise is a little bit creepy.
Certainly. We'll get to that. I'll get to that just in one sec. But it's a much, much quieter film. Mm. Derived from an attempt he had to make a television series for Netflix, which never came to fruition. Now, that may sound like an unpromising way to make a film, but Mulholland Drive was made that way. Mulholland Drive was made initially as a television series, which wasn't, and was made then turned into a film, which also premiered at Cannes. But ultimately, I think it's a better film than Crimes of the Future, though it will require patience with it because it's a very talky film. There are moments where, sorry, we should say yes. The premise is Vincent Cassel plays essentially a stand-in for Cronenberg, who was a widower who has devised this plan whereby he puts cameras in the in the coffins of dead people, and the bereaved can watch them decay either on, yeah, on a screen on the...
No, that's not creepy. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's
creepy.
Certainly extremely creepy. And it's a very fecund idea. Yeah. It gets to all kinds of notions like about, for example, the difference between kind of Roman Catholic and Protestant ways of dealing with death. And it feels to me like a very kind of like austere, yeah, Protestant way of dealing with the of a version of the more Catholic, okay, greater embrace of the memento mori.
Let's listen to a clip that features Vincent Cassella's Karsh, who's this kind of big tech guy who has these ideas of doing this. Diane Kruger, who plays the wife who has died, but also plays her twin sister, which is,
yeah,
Terry. And that's who's speaking to the Vincent Cassell character in this particular clip.
Another bad date last night. She put off by a desperation like the last one.
I'm out of practice. It's been decades since I had to seduce a woman. I'm never really sure whether I'm flirting or not.
That's what you get for having had a successful marriage. I don't have that problem.
Should I give up trying to find a girlfriend, or should I just sink gracefully into terminal asexuality?
You'll never replace Becca.
I'm not trying to. I did love that body.
What you provocatively said was a lot like mine.
You have her body.
I have my own body.
There we go. That is Vincent Cassell and Diane Kruger in a scene from the film The Shrouds, the David Cronenberg film. Donald, you get a sense there, a fair bit of dialogue in it, yeah, and in fact it perhaps does explain things to us, but the performances here are important, and that double up with Diane Kruger, how does that work?
It works very well, I think. He has visions of his wife as she goes through the various operations that unhappily failed to cure her cancer, and that's, she's a reappearance and a memento mori, a memory of her own death, and also a more general a reminder that we are all headed for the same place ultimately. It's also quite dryly funny, it should be said, that as is often the case with David Cronenberg. But I think, I mean, what I came out of this, I mean, it's a funny one, because when I saw it, I thought, is this good? As I was watching it, I think it is.
And
I think all of us were sitting there thinking, this is like, you know, this is a minor Cronenberg. It's made for a television.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think it's actually not a minor Cronenberg. I think it's exactly the kind of eccentric film that sits with you and grows in you, that is often made as a great late work by a film director. I don't want to suggest Cronenberg is winding down his career. Mm-hmm. He's a no spring chicken, but I'm sure he'll make more films. But I thought it was a genuinely fascinating, great late work that I will certainly come back to.
In the same place as The Fly, or?
Oh, well, very different kind of film, yeah, obviously. I mean, if you're going to, in looking for, like, you know, shock horror, shock body horror, you're not going to get,
yeah,
you're going to get very queasy moments, very uneasy moments, but you're not going to get, that, you know, Jeff,
yeah, that
Goldberg, decay, yeah, Jeff Goldberg, Jeff Goldblum decaying into a slime covered fly in it or anything. But I thought a very important,
and
serious
stars
film
in that regard.
4.5, I think it's I probably would have said 3.5, you know, a year ago, but it's really grown on me.
It's grown on you since that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just those films, Jurassic World Rebirth goes on general release this weekend, Hot Milk, Beat the Lotto and The Shrouds in selected cinemas from tomorrow. Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark on that. But before the two of you go, news that has come to us in the last half hour or so, I believe, the death of the actor Michael Marsden, Reservoir
Madsen.
Dogs, Madsen, Reservoir Dogs, Kill Bill, really stand out in Quentin Tarantino's films in particular, I think, Donald.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things Tarantino was great at was discovering actors, often actors who actually had careers behind them but had been ignored and hadn't got the respect that they deserved. An interesting guy, Madsen, he actually came through Steppenwolf, the famous Chicago theatre company.
John Malkovich,
etc. John Malkovich, worked with John Malkovich in a production of Mice and Men at early on, and you know, did work, was a steady character. You can spot him here or there, mm, in the corner of things, and then Tarantino discovered him essentially for Reservoir Dogs, in which he had Mr. Blonde and played the very famous scene Stuck in the Middle with You, where he chops up bits of the poor policeman's ear, which he was brilliant. He had that kind of that quality of being simultaneously sinister and actually quite comic, and one of those kind of great hard-bitten character actors that American cinema can't cope without. You know, the Warren Oates of the world, those guys are, you know,
you've seen them in a million things,
yeah,
but you can never quite remember.
Always bring something to any little scene they appear in.
Upwards of 300 credits on IMDb.
I've literally just got onto IMDb now, 328 credits. He's such a hard-working actor. Started his career doing, like, you know, the one-episode arcs that a lot of actors do, you know, Cagney and Lacey, Say Now, Swear, Miami Vice. But interestingly enough, I've got onto his IMDb and it's like he still has 18 projects that are still to come out, and only one of them is
young,
in pre-production.
67. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's really sad because he is quite young at 67. Yeah.
And he was also in Thelma and Louise.
He was Jimmy in Thelma and Louise. And I think that's when
Susan Sarandon's character, her partner.
Her partner. And I think that's when he sort of would have come into my universe. Yeah. But it's really sad to hear 67, but what a body of work he's left behind.
Yeah, and we'll suddenly notice all of those as we see the films coming up. I'm sure in the coming days. Serena and Donald, thank you both for that. And as I said, our films, the big one is on general release, the Jurassic World Rebirth, The Rest, Hot Milk, Beat the Lotto and The Shrouds in selected cinemas from tomorrow. I'll Be Right Here is the new novel from Amy Bloom, the acclaimed author of four previous novels, five collections of short stories and her best-selling memoir, In Love. I'll Be Right Here follows an unconventional family from 1940s Paris to modern-day America, telling the story of Ghazala, if I'm saying her name correctly, an Algerian Jewish girl, and her adopted brother, Samir, orphaned as children during the rise of the Nazis in Paris. And Amy Bloom joins me now from Connecticut. And I hear you saying, yes, it is Ghazala, I said.
I did mutter yes in the background. Ghazala is her name.
Yeah, well,
Ghazala and Samir.
Ghazala and Samir. Rather than guessing what was your starting point here, Amy, why don't I just ask you, what was the starting point? Because it kind of packs a lot into 200 pages from those beginnings in Paris, in Nazi-occupied Paris, through until contemporary America.
Yes, so I think there were two things. One is I never write long. I mean, I think my longest novel was maybe 225 pages, and I probably padded it a tiny bit. So they're always going to be short. And I think the starting point for this novel was really Colette, whose short stories and novels I had really loved when I was in my late teens and my 20s, and then discovering that her third marriage was her happy marriage to a man who was much younger, much less well-known, and Jewish, which really flew in the face of her upbringing. And so having been sort of a, you know, bourgeois, Parisian, you know, benign anti-Semite, she had to spend the war hiding her husband and begging him to convert and praying that he didn't, you know, get sent to a French camp or a concentration camp. And that sort of brought me into Colette's life in a different way. Mm. And then I thought, oh, who was taking care of her? She had a devoted housekeeper, and I could really picture this young woman sort of fetching up on her doorstep as people did in the middle of the war. And that became Ghazala, who lived in a tiny little room in the attic of Colette's house, as I pictured it.
And did the fictional character then start? Because, yes, Colette is there, as indeed is the jewelry designer Suzanne Bell-Perron. Similarly, you know, with difficulties regarding her husband at the time regarding his Jewishness and where he might or might not be during that period. Did the fictional characters just take over at a certain point and say, yep, okay, Colette was your starting point, Amy, but you're going to have to follow us?
Yes. Well, as it turns out, I mean, I always, Alice Walker used to say, oh, her characters would simply come and sit on the end of her bed and tell their stories. And I always thought that would be great. That has never happened to me in my household. If somebody is sitting on the end of the bed, they are looking, you know, for the aspirin or whatever it is that they need. But Ghazala has a lot of qualities of my own great aunt who had emigrated from Paris at the beginning of the 20th century and was very good at keeping her secrets and always struck me as a very complicated, interesting person. And so I sort of gave Ghazala some of that grit and some of that determination and set her in that very difficult period of upheaval in Paris.
The last time we spoke, Amy, was around the time of the memoir In Love,
yes,
which dealt with the assisted suicide of your husband. And you said to me at that time, I was listening back to some of the things you said at the time, one of the things that I really was struck by was, I'm not a memoirist and I don't expect to write another memoir.
100%.
Was there a kind of... I'm using the word relief. Why don't I ask you again, what was the emotion as you went back to fiction, given that, there was that little bit of historical character within it with Colette and indeed the jewellery designer Suzanne Bell-Perron. But what was the emotion when you got back to that place where, yeah, there wasn't somebody sitting at the bed telling you what to write? you were in control again.
Well, as in control as you can be with a novel. You know, Ed Doctorow used to say that the thing about a novel is that it's like driving a car with only one headlight in a dark forest. But the good news is you only need one headlight. And that's sort of how I felt. I was like, I was very glad to be writing fiction and making people up and solving the problems of things like timelines and, oh, did they have blenders? Or, you know, what were the cars running on in Paris in 1945? You know, those, I was glad to immerse myself in this world that certainly had a lot of historical facts and information. You know, I also used for Ghazala when she's a teenager in Paris, the true life story of the Dutch girls who were very active in the resistance in the Netherlands during the war. So there was lots of history to call on, but it was really, I was glad to be in the bodies and minds of people who were not me.
The other thing that struck me, I shouldn't keep constantly referring to In Love and that memoir, but it is very difficult not to think of you in those terms as this is the novel that comes afterwards. You spoke to me again in that interview about how, you know, you both yourself and your husband, you kind of blew up your lives in middle age in some ways.
Yeah.
And you became, I don't know, is it fair to say you became an unconventional couple in that respect? Because certainly there's a sense of unconventional family across all three eras of this novel, and how Ghazala, and when she moves to America in particular, the Coen sisters, how suddenly a whole set of unconventional relationships start to grow within this novel, and unconventional family situations. They're almost found families that you seem to be talking about in the novel.
I think that that's true. I think that found families are probably the second most common kind of family. And I suppose the thing about the conventional versus unconventional, I do have to say, I was sitting with my great aunt at one time, and this is years ago, and she was an old lady then, and we were talking about conventional couples, and I was saying something about, I knew somebody who had left her husband for another woman, and sort of wasn't that a bold choice? And my great aunt looked at me and said, I know women who have stayed with their husbands. There's a bold choice. So I feel that maybe convention and unconvention is sort of where you stand and how you look at it.
Yeah, and it sounds like your grand aunt or your great aunt was quite the character.
She was a pistol. You know, nothing scared her, and you know, I think she believed in good manners and not taking any crap.
The other relationship that grows in the novel is the relationship between Ghazala and her adopted brother, Samir. And it becomes a physical relationship and a very loving relationship. This struck me as an area that was potentially fraught with difficulty. Did you feel that as you wrote into it, or did you just let it arrive? Did you control it in a way that got rid of those that potential fraughtness?
Oh, probably not. I think that I wrote it as I sort of imagined it. And you're right. I mean, I wrote it with a lot of sort of tenderness and great care and sort of the sense of these two people always understanding themselves to be sort of alone in the world except for each other. But needless to say, when the book was finished, I certainly heard from my editor, my publisher, that there were aspects of this that were fraught. And what did I think about that? And I guess what I thought about that is, this is how I understand this relationship to be. I am not writing to recommend. I am only writing to describe.
And the reality is, there are as many types of relationship as there are people.
Yes, as it, you're right. As it turns out, you know, it is a big, big bouquet.
Yeah, and they're adopted. It's an adopted brother sister relationship,
right?
Which removes a certain aspect of some of the fraughtness away from it. However, there's another aspect of the book that starts almost from day one, but certainly when we get to America. Boy, do you like food. How do you like writing about food?
It's true. It's true. My next book is going to be a collection of food essays. I do like to cook.
And in the writing of fiction, I mean, a collection of food essays is one thing, but in the writing of fiction, food allows you for, well, of course, people have to sit down and eat a meal together. It's a great moment of gathering.
Yes, it is. And I mean, whether the meal is good or terrible, you know, the point is everybody being together. And sometimes the terrible meals are just as memorable.
Possibly.
So I like that part. I do. I am partial to the kitchen table.
But what struck me about that, and I don't know what type of cook you are in that regard.
I'm a pretty good cook.
Yeah, and are you you know, you seem to write with a kind of a care and a sparseness. Do you cook in that way, or do you throw everything into the pot and see what comes out?
Oh, maybe a little bit more of the former. When my kids were young, you know, the whole point was, can you get dinner on the table after you come home from work,
and
can you
get them
on the
to
table
eat it
in 20 minutes? Yeah, well, I was sufficiently old-fashioned that I will say that most of the time they ate it, but or some variation of it. But if I don't have to cook, I really like it. But even when I have to cook, there's a certain kind. I was a short order cook, actually, when I was a teenager. And so there's a certain kind of pride in being able to turn it out, have it be edible, and it is on the plate in under 15 minutes.
Now, I don't know if I'm going to make a terribly fraught type of parallel between short order cooking now and the nature of your writing.
But, oh, you go ahead.
I'll give it a go. You know, when you sit down at the desk, how hard are you on yourself? Are you very precise about what you will even allow to be put down on the page or onto the screen or whatever way you're doing it? Are you very careful at that point in time, or do you accept that there will be a number of drafts and you will have to hone this down and edit it back? You know, how difficult are you on yourself in that regard?
Well, you know, maybe more than some, less than others. It is certainly not every once in a while it's the perfect polished sentence, and that's a delightful surprise. More often it is an approximation of it. It's on the way. You know, I've got most of it. I've got the movement, but it's not as smooth as I'd like it to be. It's not silky. It doesn't maybe illuminate character and advance the plot and be an interesting sentence. And those are sort of my standards. So maybe I'm hitting 2 out of 3, and then I'll go back over it and over it. I don't mind revising. I think for me, rewriting is a great opportunity.
All right.
You know, it's like getting to, you know, whatever, brush your hair before you walk out the door. It's a gift. I'm glad to be able to do it.
And unlike short order cooking, you can take things out in the rewrite. You can't take things out of the recipe if you put them in.
No, and I am much more likely to take things out than to put more things in.
I would have thought so. Amy, lovely to have spoken with you again, and thanks for being with us this evening on the programme.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Until next time.
Until next time, indeed. That is Amy Bloom speaking to us about her novel, I'll Be Right Here, which is published by Granta. A slumbering goddess, four devoted tribes, fire, ritual and skybound performances. Ephemera is not your typical closing festival event, as the finale of this year's Carja Festival in Sligo, the large-scale outdoor spectacle, weaves ancient myth, contemporary ritual into a communal journey through the heart of Sligo town. At the centre of it all is Volki Dania, a new spectacle company founded by designer and street artist Bridget Nguyen and contemporary circus director Polina Shekina. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Polina, and on the line from Kilkenny by Bridget. So we've had a little bit of a chat beforehand, Polina. Let's get stuck into Volki Dania, because that will explain lots to us about you and about Bridget, in fact, indeed. So I'll only ask you to explain what Volki is.
Yeah, so Volki is Russian for wolves, or German for folk, and Dania is Irish for cheeky. Or bold. And because, you know, I'm myself like Eastern European descent and Bridget is extremely Irish. So we kind of merged our cultural backgrounds there.
Yeah. And Bridget Nguyen, I suppose that gives us the sense that you are extremely Irish, Bridget, for sure, as Polina has put it there. Ephemera, then, who's this firelit goddess, I think, is she a demi? Or is that only part of what Ephemera is about?
Well, I suppose she's kind of the main character. She is a 5 meter tall effigy of a goddess we have created. Mm. And the whole story is based around her. She's been slumbering on the earth for eons. A lot of people have forgotten her, but word spreads across different dimensions and universes that she's going to wake up and have her last walk and change into her next form. And it's all happening in Sligo Town.
Yeah, I'll tell you to put on your headphones, because you won't be able to hear. You won't be able to hear Bridget if you don't do that. And Bridget, your journey towards this type of work, I guess, that you're involved in here with Volki Dania, was, first of all, you studied under Monica Frawley, the great designer, stage designer, but then you went off to Taiwan. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how that has fed into particularly what you're doing in Ephemera.
Yeah, well, I'd say I probably owe everything to Taiwan, really. I'd probably be in a nice space just designing theatre if I hadn't landed there. But yeah, I went straight over after my degree, was kind of just curious to have some experiences in the arts outside of Europe. I was always kind of inspired by Southeast Asia's kind of culture of masks and puppetry. And when I ended up in Taiwan, I just kind of just by luck, I guess that's the Irish in me, ended up falling into a spectacle company in Taiwan that kind of specialized in just like massive, big, large scale street processional work. And when I landed up there, I just thought, oh my God, this is incredible, because it was so community based. It was so like the scale was something that was so new to me. And so I just really like got stuck in. I was volunteering at first, and then I made sure I became really good friends with everyone until everyone gave me a job because they were too sad to see me go. And that's where it all started. I worked under four artists over there who were all Balinese, and they were just incredible with every material possible.
And so in terms of how the division of labour is between yourself and Polina then, are you very much on that kind of design and visual side of things, and Polina on the story and the mythical side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think me and Polly have been really lucky that if you were to draw a Venn diagram, the kind of mythical and otherworldly thing is kind of in the center of that. So it's something we kind of like to bounce off of each other quite regularly. And then I guess I will take the ideas and go to my workshop and start drawing them out and start designing them. Mm. And Polina is obviously a mover and a choreographer, and that's where she takes things to. So we're a lovely pair.
Yeah, well, it sounds as if it's a marriage made in heaven. And in terms of of the community involvement? Because I think that, as Bridget has been mentioning there, the community side of things was important in Taiwan when she saw that there. How are you involving the local groups in what you're doing in Sligo, Paulina?
Well, we have invited the Queer Shed, the Men's Shed, the Congolese community and the Sligo Youth Theatre to join us on our journey. So they've been taking workshops with Alta Creations. And these workshops are in sort of costume making and lantern building.
So people will actually, I presume with help from you guys, they will make their own costumes, they will design their own, how they look themselves?
Well, they've been on the process with Alta Creations. Mm. And they've been kind of, they're going to be part of the performance. They are these four tribes that are coming together to kind of guide this deity to her final destination, and they've been working on the designs together with Alta Creations. So yeah,
in terms of, is it purely spectacle, Bridget, or is there a musical side, a drumming side, or that's is there a kind of an aural side to the event as well?
Yeah, we are collaborating currently with Sal Stapleton. They're an amazing kind of multidisciplinary artist, to be fair. But Sal has composed the music for us, so we've been really lucky to work with Sal. They've also been designing the lighting design on it. So there's some really incredible artists who have joined myself and Polly on this journey of creating this big piece of spectacle, because it really is a big piece of spectacle. So we've got a mix of lovely artists who've come in and lent a hand.
And from the way you're explaining to me, it does sound as if it absolutely has to be outdoors, Paulina. Is there something, have you worked together or have you plans to work together on an indoor theatre, or is it this big outdoor spectacle that really attracts you both?
Well, to be honest, we're interested in all things mystical, wacky and wonderful. I have a love for the black box, as does Bridget. You know, I have solo work that takes place in a theatre that Bridget has collaborated on. We're only 1 year old, actually.
Yeah, so watch this space.
Exactly, yeah.
Watch this space, both indoors and outdoors. Thank you both for being with me this evening. That's Bridget Nguyen joining us on the line from Kilkenny, Paulina Shapkina with me here in Studio Ephemera. Carja's closing procession will take place on this coming Saturday, which is the July the 12th in Sligo Town, carjafestival.com. For full details. And just before we go, I'd like to congratulate all the team at the legendary Druid Theatre, who are marking their 50th anniversary of their first production tonight in Galway. From humble beginnings in 1975, the company has grown to be one of the country's most foremost arts organisations, promoting new and established writers at home and, of course, abroad. Founded by Marie Mullen, Gary Hines and, of course, the late actor Mick Lally. Since then, it has produced works from established and emerging writers, platforming new approaches to theatre, while all the while staying firmly rooted to its founding aims and its Galway base. And we are looking forward to joining the Druid team in Galway as they put on their latest double bill for the Galway International Arts Festival. It'll be Shakespeare's Macbeth, the Scottish play, should I be saying, while I'm on air, and Riders to the Sea by John Millington Synge. That will be the other play. They're performing those as a double bill. We here on Arena will be broadcasting for two nights from the Galway International Arts Festival, a show from the Town Hall Theatre on Thursday, July the 17th, meeting lots of those involved in shows from Moonfish Theatre, Decadent and, of course, Druid. And we will have live music at both shows, including a session with Bernard Butler, co-writer and guitarist with Suede. I hope you will be able to join us for all of that and enjoy things in Galway with us during the week of these Thursday the 17th and Friday the 18th. That is our lot for this Thursday evening here on Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Senan Cullinan was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Mullen was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.